Hello, this is 88.9 FM Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr and you're listening to Frank Prattle. Today I have a very lovely guest with me, Janelle Porter, the Associate Curator of the Institute for Contemporary Art here in Philadelphia. We're located in the lovely library right now of this fine institution. And Janelle, why don't you tell us a little bit about this raging show that you just curated called Locally Localized Gravity.
Raging is a good word. Ragingly out of control at some moments. I and two of my colleagues here, Naomi Beckwith and Elise Gonzalez, have organized, and I use the word loosely, this exhibition called Locally Localized Gravity, which we all celebrated the opening of on Friday night. It is an exhibition that first focuses on Philadelphia artists who are adding and creating a lot of energy to the scene, to the local scene here, by running spaces, hosting events. Basically, they are the art world. Those groups are Space 1026, Lure, Basecamp, and Black Floor. And I call them all groups, though sometimes they're groups of 30, like 1026, sometimes they're groups of one, like Lure. And primarily the focus of this show and the reason that we chose these people was that they're all artists who sort of work as producers, as we say, which is kind of a shorthand for saying.
Like Mel Brooks, you mean?
In a sense, yeah. Mostly artists who, they make work on their own as artists, but they also do these really generous activities of running galleries, which is a huge amount of work, or hosting these huge events, opening up their spaces to concerts. I'm always amazed sometimes at kind of what the rambunctiousness that goes on in these spaces, and a lot of these people live there, and I think, oh my God, I would never have all of these people in my home,
right.
They do. It's just incredibly generous, but then we wanted to kind of expand the notion of artist-producer out to other cities where this kind of activity happens, and it seems to really happen, especially in cities where the art world isn't such a huge presence. New York. Though LTTR, one of the groups in the show, is primarily from New York. So exceptions to every rule. But we have Red 76 from Portland and beyond, Fritz Haig from Los Angeles, and Matt Bauckham from Minneapolis. So in total, 8 entities, I'll say.
One of the things that I noticed most about the show is that whereas most art shows, you go, you show up, you know, you pay, you don't pay, whatever. You get in, and you look at the art, and that's the art on the wall. And, you know, maybe, you know, you sneak some photos, or, you know, or you, you know, kind of look at it and take some notes, and then that's it. That's the show. One of the variations with this show seems to be that it's a more process-oriented show where there's, you know, kind of group activities coming, you know, back to it. Like, so if you went to the opening, you might not see all the art.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So the idea for the show is that we as curators would invite these 8 groups and, in a sense, after that, cede our curatorial power to the groups. So our job was to invite...
How is that for you?
And that is a struggle for all of us. It's a good struggle, though, but it is at moments, you know, very difficult to kind of... Well, maybe I'll get into that after I answer sort of the first question, first part of the question. But the idea was that since all of these groups make things happen, we sort of said, okay, here's some space, the ICA. Here's a little money, you know, $5. You know, what do you want to do? And we got proposals, and then it became our job to basically manage the proposals. How much space did this group want? How much money did this group need to do what they wanted to do? So it just became this kind of shuffling / juggling act of trying to figure that out. And luckily for us, I would say, is that a lot of the proposals we received were somewhat characteristic of the size of the groups, the scale of their projects, you know, et cetera. Space 1026 asked for the largest space. Nobody else needed that much space.
Right.
So we kind of said, go for it. They didn't need that much money because there's 30 of them that could basically all throw in their hands and brains to make that piece.
For the listeners out there, Space 1026 built an entire Ewok village with, I believe, a 50-foot pillar.
Yes.
Gallery inside with tree branches, rope bridges, video kiosks, everything.
There's a milk crate stage. There's a ziggurat element there. It's pretty over the top.
It's yeah, it's a village.
It's a village.
Little village. Yeah, complete.
It takes a village.
Yeah.
And but then Lure wanted the terrace, which is our very underutilized outdoor space off of our mezzanine. That's actually the roof of our auditorium. And nobody ever uses that space. And, you know, I said, great. And they built in a huge working greenhouse,
right,
which clearly there's no reason to make a greenhouse inside a gallery. So it's kind of exciting that they use that. Whereas LTTR just wanted a table to show their publication. So part two of that installation, or part two of the show after the installations were made, was all of these groups installing, or I'm sorry, all these groups producing events. So we had the opening, and that's all good, but now there's 75 events over 10 weeks. So the idea is that somebody would come back to the ICA lot, because that's actually the true experience of the show. What you're seeing when you come into the exhibition, if nothing's going on, is actually something quite visual. There's a lot to read, there's a lot of video to look at, there's actually a lot of kind of aesthetic beauty in the show, or at least kind of aesthetic experiences. Yeah, but all of the groups have scheduled events, from concerts to lectures to discussions, and then so there's things happening inside the gallery, and then there's things happening out in the world. So this is a pretty big task,
right,
of management for all of us.
It seems as we kind of touched on a little bit before, mm-hmm, and then skipped away, was that, you know, the role of the curator here is seems to be switching. Do you think this is kind of, well, let's first get your opinion on what it means to be a curator of this kind of, like, you know, energy, and then I'd like to hear if you think that's kind of indicative of where the field's going as well.
What it's like to curate this show?
Wait,
what it's
really
like?
Suck.
What it's like to curate this show? We should just say that we've all had a very long week, shouldn't we? What it was like to curate this show?
Yes. Because you had mentioned, and I'm going to,
yes,
use previous conversation here,
which she, you should she, never do.
She hasn't said it, but inside sources tell me that she typically does not curate this way.
Typically, as an art curator, you are, let's just use one example of, a pretty good example of how you curate exhibitions. You have a theme, you select artists, and you select objects around that theme, and you install them very sort of carefully in a space so that associations are made, the story is told, someone can come in and see your theme or idea illustrated in objects. And that's how you do a show. This show was more choosing people who would then do whatever they wanted to do. My eyes are closed, aren't they? Sorry. So, with this exhibition, we weren't selecting objects. We were selecting artists. Now, that's not to say that the way that,
I'm sorry for the
distracting
audience. I'm taking pictures.
Jeffrey's taking pictures, and I have lightning fast reflexes, and my eyes will be closed in every single one of those. At ICA, we commission a lot of work.
Right.
Our ramp space is a commissioned space, which means that we invite an artist based on past work to address our ramp, which is a 90-foot-long zigzagging space that's all windows on one side. It's
right.
Impossible to light. It's
right.
Impossible to really experience it. You would never hang like just paintings in the ramp because it would not be interesting. But we invite artists to make these installations. You know, you don't know what it's going to look like, but
right.
You often have long discussions with the artists, and there's a lot of planning involved, and so maybe there's a tiny bit more control than existed with this exhibition, which was
right.
Really sort of letting go completely. But it's hard because you also want to make sure that the artists are doing the best project that they can do, that it's being installed in a clear way, that the information is being presented well. I mean, you really do think about all those things, because as a curator, you think about visitor experience. You have to. If not, you might as well just, you know, be a freelance curator.
Right.
And when you work in a museum, you have to think about the way that people will experience it. I don't know if people are going to come back for 75 events. I mean,
people already have come to
other. Yeah. Well, that's true, and that's great, events. And people are very excited, but. Is this way of working indicative? I don't think so, necessarily. I mean, it is a way that a lot of curators choose to work, to sort of be, to really, really take a backseat role. But there's always shows that need to exist where you're just working, you're doing a theme show, or you're working with an artist to do kind of a solo survey. I mean, that's just a very different way of working. And there are more artists working in more expansive ways, but
any particulars that you can name?
Well, I would say everybody in the show. So, for example, Red 76, which you collaborated on this piece with them.
There's insider information.
Insider information. Red 76 mostly works outside of art institutions, and when they come into working in arts institutions. You know, they have to address that as well, but so much of what they do is, you know, for example, the installation that is downstairs in our gallery is mostly an information site for things that have happened already, for things that are going to happen. And a lot of those things aren't happening inside our galleries.
Right.
Whereas Black Floor's piece, they have created a portable black floor, a giant black platform, where they will be having one-day exhibitions. So in a sense, everything they're doing is happening inside of our walls.
Right. Tell me if I'm wrong about this,
yeah.
But I kind of look at it like, and you know, this is a horrible analogy now that's actually coming to mind. But but with our Congress, we elect these people, right?
Yeah.
And then we don't necessarily get to choose what they do. You know, we put our trust in them, you know, for better or worse, and then they get to kind of run the show from there.
Yeah.
Would you consider that a good analogy for this type of curation?
Yeah, actually. I mean, you've voted for them on the basis of their past history.
Right.
And then
they're
go to town. I mean, I had several occasions during the installation of this show where I realized that I just had no control whatsoever, that even my voice wasn't necessarily being heard when I put my thoughts out there. That in a sense...
Red 76 always listened to you, though.
You know, and I don't think it's that people didn't necessarily care. I think we were just past that.
Right.
You know, where I kind of, at one point, had to say, you know, I concede. Like, my role here is done. I'm the manager of this show. I just have to make sure that it gets done, that the artists have everything they need,
right,
to within reason. I mean, we did everything we could.
Right.
Every avenue was explored before no's were given out.
Right.
And with the events, it's just a matter of publicizing them, of making sure that everybody gets here and they happen.
Right.
That it's cleaned up afterwards, ready for the next event.
This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and you're listening to Frank Prattle. I'm live with Janelle Porter, who is the Associate Curator of the Institute of Contemporary Art of Philadelphia. We were talking just a little bit about your show that you curated recently, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about your history as well, because it's, you know, from what I've heard, you've done a bit of moving around, a bit of shuffling. What... Tell us how you got into the curatorial field. I mean, why this?
Totally by accident, I would say. With, you know, some luck thrown in and working on some great shows. I didn't know that I wanted to be a curator. I don't think I knew what a curator was when I was younger. But I used to go to museums, and there were some shows that made a huge impression on me, but sort of moving up, I went to school in New York and did an internship at the Whitney Museum, and after that internship, I got asked back to do another internship
at the Whitney,
met great people. After I graduated, I got a job there as a curatorial assistant to Lisa Phillips. Great, great job. Learned a huge amount. I worked on 3 major exhibitions in 3 years, which was pretty unprecedented for a museum schedule where a curator maybe does 1 show every 2 or 3 years, sometimes even longer. But I worked on a show about beat culture. I worked on an Ed Kienholz retrospective, and I worked on a Whitney Biennial, the 97 Whitney Biennial. And it was that biennial where I was really working with living artists, young artists who were coming in and making installations that I just got really excited about the prospect of, that you can work in a museum, you can work with living artists, you can show their work, have these relationships. It was just incredibly exciting. After that, I went to do this great internship program that the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis has. It's a 1-year program for, it's more of a fellowship. I think internship is almost the wrong word, because most of the people who do the internship have maybe just come out of master's or PhD programs, have already worked, and want to kind of focus a bit more. I wasn't an assistant anymore. I actually worked on an exhibition.
Right.
I was more of a research assistant. After that, I became the curator at Artist Space in New York, which was an incredibly valuable experience of doing, being responsible for or curating 3 to 4 shows every 8 weeks.
Wow.
Responsible meaning either working with the guest curator,
right,
choosing the artist myself for, theme shows or one-person shows. I installed the work, usually with the artist. We didn't have a crew. I mean, this is, a nonprofit, very small, so it was very hands-on. Did a lot of publications. I basically was exhausted after 3 years.
Yeah, man.
But I am still working with some of the artists. For example, Matt Bauckham, that's in the show, Locally Localized Gravity show, is somebody I showed at Artist Space that I did a project with. After that, went to Los Angeles for my first lifestyle choice. got a master's degree out there, worked at Blum & Poe for a little while, came to ICA, all the way back to the East Coast. I've been here for 2 years. So yes, the curatorial field is one in which you must be open to moving a lot, which is hard, but it's a necessity. Some people stay forever. Most people move a lot.
Right.
So that's my story.
Well, one of the questions I have about it is, you mentioned working with living artists as being important.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's one of the main things that you try to focus on in your own practice? I mean, it seems to be in this latest show that you just put together, but is it also...
I haven't thought about it that clearly, but yes, that is the case. When I am not interested in doing, say, historical exhibitions, meaning historical exhibitions of artists who are no longer with us.
Right.
But essentially, most of those sorts of shows are being done at places like the Met and the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I mean, you don't find a lot of artists, dead artists, for example, even showing at MoMA, which is like the biggest,
right,
museum of modern art and contemporary art. So I don't think that we would think to do a big show of an artist who wasn't alive. However, I know that there have been some theme shows with some artists who, died young. Like, I know that Ingrid Schaffner, my boss, did a show called The Big Nothing, and that James Lee Byers and Bastian Otter were both in that show, and they're no longer alive. But that was a very big group show with, I think, probably 40 or 50 artists in it. It was,
wow,
slightly before my time. But so, if you're doing a theme show and your topic needs to be addressed as such, it happens. But working with living artists is just, it's so rewarding. It's also incredibly hard. I mean, some curators sort of have a rule, the deader the better.
Mm.
but I couldn't see working that way. And I've even heard, I know of a curator who's working on a show of an artist who recently died and died young. And she has told me that it is a huge challenge and she would never do a show of an artist who wasn't alive anymore. That the fact that you can't talk to the artist about,
right,
the work is so hard. I mean, you're basically working with secondary material. You're acting as a historian and a scholar, and though part of my practice is to be a historian and a scholar, the biggest part of my practice is to do shows of artists who are alive and to work with those artists and have that conversation and help them make work.
Right.
It's sort of the best part of the job.
Well, speaking of those artists, who are some of your faves now that perhaps you haven't mentioned?
this is a tough one, but it's a little easier right now because I just wrote an article for the Believer magazine where they asked me to
choose publication.
They asked me to choose 10 artists, and I chose 10 women artists who I think are incredibly interesting.
Give us a little scoop. An insider track.
You want me to rattle off the list, and this might be hard, but it's
just one or two is fine.
Andrea Bowers, Nicole Cherubini, who's showing in our project space right now, Jessica Jackson Hutchins, Rosemary Trockel is someone I'm in love with. Those are just a few of the 10, but I'm also doing a project with Trisha Donnelly here next January, and she's somebody whose work I encountered first at Artist Space. She had her first exhibition there. She was in a group show when she had just graduated from Yale, and her work just blew me away, like right on the spot. And she was just out of grad school.
Right.
And she makes work that is so hard to describe, which I think is why I like it. I always like work that you can't put your finger on so easily. That, you know, it's so hard when someone says, well, why do you like this artist's work? And I think it's always better when you can't tell them why.
Right.
Because if you can say why, then sometimes I feel like you're done
with
it. So she's somebody who constantly inspires me. I just did a show last year with some artists who really are huge favorites: Charles Long, Liz Larner, Mark Grotjohn, Evan Holloway. And since I had been living in LA just recently, and since I'm from there, I find that I have a lot of favorites who are West Coast artists more than anything.
Right.
There's this guy Matthew Monahan from LA who I think is tremendous, and I really want to do something with him. So, you know, I have my favorites, and I'm total groupies when I meet them. I'm like a total groupie when I meet them. Like, I love your work.
We'd kind of gone around this a little bit before, but I mean, I know with myself, I am pretty cautious about meeting the people that I respect the most, like rock stars, definitely. You know, like, I mean, I love certain bands' music, you know, but I don't want to fucking know them because if they're an asshole, it'll kill me.
It's hard. You know? I've had that experience with artists.
Do you have a similar policy, or do you like to meet
them? No, I usually do, because I know that how nice it is when somebody, I mean, you're talking about rock stars and you like their music. I guess there's certain curators or artists who I love their work or what they've done, and I will go up to them and tell them that.
Right. Do you find that hard?
No, I don't find it hard
at all.
You just
like, I'd love it.
I do. I mean, there's curators that I've met that I've just really been in awe of, and I just will usually say, I'm a huge fan of the work that you do. And I just know how much it means to me when somebody says it.
Yeah.
I was recently looking at a publication that was done by a curator at the Bard. I'll get the name wrong, but it's the Bard Center for Decorative Art. It's in New York. And they did a book of this artist, Sheila Hicks, and it's been so much on my mind lately. It's the most beautiful book. I've never heard of this artist. She's a textile artist. I saw the book at the Whitney. I ordered it. You know, it's just a huge brick of a book, so I didn't want to buy it and carry it home. So, of course, I ordered it from Amazon, like we all do. And I was so moved by the book. The designer is one of my favorite designers. This Dutch designer named Irma Boom. The material is incredible. The artwork is so moving. I was devastated that I missed the show, which just happened last fall. And I wrote the curator an email, and I said how moved I was by the book and that she should be so proud of this kind of scholarship that she did and the show of this artist who most people don't know. And she wrote me back and was like, thank you so much. And I just think it's kind of, the art world can be so insincere, and I think it's just nice when you get these little moments of sincerity when somebody actually says to you, you know, I really like your work. And I will tell an artist, I really love your work. I would love to do something with you someday. Who knows when it will be? I mean, I've met artists that I've said that to and done something with them 5 years later.
Right.
But I remember people, and I remember what they do. And as a curator, you have to be selective. I can't show everybody that I want to work with.
Right.
But I can try to be supportive in other ways. You know, when somebody asks you to make a list of the 10 artists that you really like, I mean, I will probably never get to do a show with Rosemary Trockel. she's of a different generation. She's showing at bigger museums, and she's getting the attention that she deserves. And I might want to throw my attention at somebody else that, you know.
A young scrapper.
Yeah, like I like working with artists of my own generation. And while I sort of look up to somebody like Rosemary Truckle and think her work is so important, she should be working with curators, you know, of her generation. That's the kind of, I guess, attention they deserve. And not to sell myself short, but I sort of love that when I was in my 20s, I was doing shows of artists in their 20s, and now that I'm in my 30s, I'm kind of working with artists of that generation right. And around it. And that's the experience I'm interested in having in the art world.
I had a question for you.
Yes.
We talked about this a little bit before, and this is the role of curatorial school and the modern curator. Now, there's a rash of brand new school programs coming out across the globe to teach young people how to curate. Bullshit or no?
I think I know how you want me to answer this based on our bar conversation.
You having gone to a program.
I attended a curatorial studies program at UCLA, and
right.
I attended that program for two reasons. One, I have serious doubts about the merit of curatorial studies programs.
Okay. Why?
Because I don't think that you can go to school to be a curator. I think that the best way to become a curator is like the apprentice model, let's say. Or maybe it's a little like going to art school. I think people go to art school for the connections that they will get. You don't go to art school to learn how to be an artist. When you go to art school, you already are an artist. And you go probably to have a little more time, to spend time with other artists and professors who will feed you. And I just don't think that you can go to school, curate a show, and then think that you're going to get a job as a curator in a museum. I have worked with a lot of people who don't know how to curate, who are curators. And
right.
It can be a very frustrating experience. And this is not to kind of say, oh, well, I know how to be a curator, but I just kind of wish maybe that everybody could have been an assistant at one point so that they know what it's like to actually, the mechanics of actually putting a show together.
Right.
It's amazing how many curators don't know the mechanics of making a show.
Right.
And it's the half your job.
Right.
You know, there's the dream and then there's the pragmatic reality of making a show. So, but I was actually, the other part of the reason that I went to this program I did is that it was this kind of free form thing where you went to UCLA, you could take classes anywhere on campus, and then you curated a show at the Hammer. But I ended up doing a book on Stephen Prina, and that was just an idea that I threw out to them, and they said okay, because I was thinking about making an exhibition in a book rather than having it be, you know,
right.
in a physical location. But I was not, if I had not had 8 years of experience working as an assistant or a curator, I wouldn't have known how to curate because I went to the program that I did.
Right.
That all sounds kind of negative, but I guess it's just sort of you know, the negatives. Now, I do think the schools that have been around longer, like Bard, are actually pretty good, but I think all of us who sort of have been working for a while just think, you know, they don't want to be an assistant when they come out of a program like that, because
right.
if a master's
they want
degree,
to be the boss.
They want to be in charge.
Right.
And just think it takes a little more than that. I mean, yeah. That is my unblemished opinion. Unvarnished?
I was wondering, there is a question that I like to ask people,
mm-hmm.
and that particular question is, if I was to kind of sneak out the door here and go rummage around in my backpack and come back in a couple minutes and hand you a slip of paper that happened to be a $25 million check, what would you do with that check in regards to the art world?
Oh, my God.
And I was like, make me a show. Make me the best fucking show in the galaxy.
You want me to make a show with $25 million?
Yes.
So I don't get to do whatever I want. You want me to make a show
you
with
can,
$25
no, million? You can, well, you, I'll expand that. You can do whatever the hell you want with $25 million. Tax-free. A little count in Barbados.
I've always had this dream that I've worked in museums for a long time, and there's a certain situation in museums where there's a lot of people that help you. There's a lot of wealthy people that give their time and their money to help. They do it for various reasons, which we don't need to go into.
Sure.
Let's just say there's a large parts of the museum that go unfunded because there's no sort of sexiness to them.
Right.
And I always wish that if I had a lot of money, that I would be the person that gave the money to the operations budget of a museum. So maybe the bathroom could be fixed up, or salaries could be raised, or make changes to the physical plant, like these sort of things that never get to happen, because at the end of the day, when you have to make a choice between fixing up the bathroom or having an exhibition, if you're a museum,
right,
you put on the exhibition. I would know what to do with $25 million. There's no exhibition in the world that costs that much money.
Not yet.
Well, actually, that's not true. I don't know what budgets for Documenta and the Venice Biennale and things like that are. They're probably somewhere
probably more than that.
Up there and far beyond that. But I'm just sort of like old-fashioned that I would want to give the money to museums, and I would want to give the money to artists to like have health insurance, stuff like that.
That's good. That's a good answer.
Even artists that are out there making money and winning awards you think must be set, they're not set at all. They're like paycheck to paycheck. Their rent is based on the next painting that they can sell. And I think it would just be, people have always sort of dreamed of setting up these kind of programs for artists, but it's just really impossible in so many ways. So that's kind of my answer in a roundabout way.
That's a good answer. Thanks. I mean, that was better than take it to Mexico and see ya.
And snort it.
Yeah. Bye. Well, thank you so much, Janelle.
Thank you, Zephyr. It's nice talking to you.
My name is Zephyr, and this is Frank Prattle. You're listening to 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio in San Francisco and the entire universe. I've had Janelle Porter, the Associate Curator of the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia, on. And she was a firecracker. She was a real live wire.
Thank you.